Chapter 15. 1524 hours, December 13th, 2553, Military Calendar. Keeper Detention Center, Salvation Base, Moon Terum, Pedoran Planetary System, Shaps System. At the bottom of the stairs in the Keeper Detention Center, Veda spotted a trail of damp boot prints leading across the intake vestibule toward the exit. They were so fresh that beads of water still stood in the tracks nearest the doorway. Beyond the opening, she could see only a sliver of lake, its waves sloshing against each other in a haphazard pattern that suggested a squall had settled in. Veda released the body she was dragging and pointed to the trail, then signaled Mark to investigate while she covered the doorway. Leaving Catalin's and Yuso's corpses next to their father's, Mark shouldered his BR-85, dropped to a knee, and peered around the corner. Almost instantly, he spoke over TeamCom. "Ash, that you?" "Tell me you're not alone," came the reply. "He's not," Veda said. She peered around the corner and saw a rifle barrel protruding past the side of the counter, with a single brown eye peering over the top. "What are you doing here?"
"Looking for you."
Ash lowered the rifle but remained concealed behind the counter awaiting visual verification. During the ferret's field training, redundant precaution had been drilled into them until it became second nature.
"You recover the packages?"
"All three," Veda said. With Mark still covering her from the staircase, she grabbed Kerpasi's corpse by the collar and dragged it into the foyer.
"Just not alive. Damn."
Ash rose and started across the vestibule. He was carrying a BR-85, no doubt from the same weapons locker Mark had forced open earlier.
"We need to get moving. Blue Team will be here any minute."
"Blue Team?" Mark said. He remained in position, his weapon still trained on Ash's chest.
"How do you figure?"
"Temporal divergence." Ash ignored the rifle and continued forward. "I think it has something to do with the massive artificial gravity inside the base. Or maybe the Forerunner vacuum energy extractor that's powering it. Anyway, something is bending space-time around."
"Ash, theory later."
Veda motioned Mark to lower his weapon.
"Just give us a sit-rep."
Ash raised his eyes toward the ceiling, then exhaled sharply.
"Okay. From your perspective, it probably seems like we left the stolen faith less than 30 minutes ago.
I think it has something to do with a vacuum energy extractor and the way it bends time-space."
"Ash!" Veda urged.
"Right," Ash said. "To Olivia? You've been MIA for 5 hours, and she's surrounded by keepers, a force well in excess of 100. The Silent Joe pinged her a few minutes ago, so she assumes Blue Team is on its way. And she's pretty sure the Turaco belongs to Dark Moon."
"Dark Moon?"
Veda glanced down at the corpses of the Tua family, and a glimmer of understanding began to tickle the back of her mind.
"Ah, that might explain the delivery squad that arrived ahead of us."
"To you, maybe." Mark shot Ash a still suspicious glare.
"I'm still trying to figure out how Blue Team shows up 5 hours early."
Ash shrugged.
"What can I tell you?
Theory later."
"Right."
Veda paused, considering whether to free the other captives they had seen upstairs earlier. With more than 100 keepers outside, there was going to be a battle, and a bunch of scared prisoners would either get in the way or get killed. It troubled her to leave them behind, but she probably wouldn't be doing them any favors. At least not until the keepers were neutralized. And the safety of her own team came first. Veda motioned toward the corpses.
"We need to get these bodies back to the Silent Joe if we can," she said. "Everybody grab one for now. But if we get in trouble..."
"Got it," Mark said. "Don't die defending a corpse."
"Exactly," Veda said. "Now let's go see about Livy."
Mark led the way, carrying his battle rifle in one hand and dragging Catalin's corpse with the other. Ash followed with Yuso, and Veda brought up the rear pulling Kerbasi, the heaviest of the three. That probably made sense, as Mark and Ash could actually fire accurately one-handed and would be that much more precise with lighter loads.
But still, teenagers.
Veda dug her fingers into Kerbasi's wrist and struggled to keep up.
Leaving a trail of gore behind was hardly the ideal way to preserve evidence or respectfully transfer a body, but under the circumstances it was the best they could do. They stepped through the doorway onto the lake, and Veda began to hear the sound of a distant battle, mostly small arms fire, but also the thunder of a single large explosion. The combatants remained hidden beyond the mysterious veil of the lake, as did the Dark Moon delivery squad, whose tracks they had seen earlier. But the Turaco and Stolen Faith were both visible, sitting on the surface of the lake with waves breaking against their struts from all directions, and on the far side of the spaceport, vessels seemed to be popping into existence one after the other, simply appearing on the provisioning apron every time Veda blinked. As they splashed across the churning water toward the Turaco, the thunder of the explosion quickly died away. The small arms fire only grew louder and more urgent, and the three of them had traveled no more than 10 paces before Mark and Ash released the bodies and threw themselves prone. Veda followed their lead and landed not in water, but on the hard light pavement of the spaceport. 50 meters ahead stood the Turaco, swaying on its struts as the dorsal turret pulsed blue laser fire into a swarm of charging keepers. From the looks of it, they had emerged from the time divergence just in time for the firefight. Behind the keepers, the Stolen Faith was wrapped in scaffolding, her forward boarding ramp gaping open and a rectangular hull breach just behind the cockpit. And in the distance beyond the star sloop's stern, 200 meters beyond the Stolen Faith, lay the remains of an Owl insertion craft. One of the curved wings had been torn away and lay resting on its back, rocking and spinning and spraying long tongues of burning fuel into the air. The cockpit sat nearby, a crushed metal cube smeared with blood streaks and scorch marks. The body of the craft was barely visible, a battle-pocked stretch of gray hull concealed behind curtains of flame and smoke. Oh, not good. Veda felt like she had swallowed liquid nitrogen. Her stomach was cold and churning, and she ached with fear for Fred and the rest of Blue Team. Guys, we'd better not count on support. Haven't needed it so far, Mark said. But we'll definitely need the Turaco to make it out of here, which means we've got to stop them first. He pointed the tip of his battle rifle toward an area 15 meters shy of the Turaco, where the 4-member Dark Moon squad was struggling to reach their craft. The squad was attempting to advance via the classic leapfrog, with the female operative kneeling to fire beneath the Turaco's belly, while her companions raced forward in an evasive zigzag. But one of her squad mate's legs had been shredded by spiker fire, and he was being dragged along by the other 2 men, slowing their advance and making it more difficult to dodge. As Veda watched, the female operative took a shot to the head and tumbled backward into a red spray. "Permission to open fire on the Dark Moon squad?" Mark asked. "We need to find out who sent them," Veda said. They weren't so close to the battle that she had to shout to make herself heard, but she did need to raise her voice. "It would be good to take at least one of them alive." "Affirmative," Mark said. "Ash, I'll take arms, you take legs." "Right to left," Ash called back. "On my mark." 4 shots rang so close together that Veda heard them as one, and the man on the right end of the Dark Moon squad went limp, twisting first right, then left, as the Spartan rounds shattered his limbs. The operative on the left end spun toward the ferrets and started to raise his battle rifle one-handed, but Mark and Ash were already firing again. The man's weapon arm jerked and dropped to his side. Then his knee buckled and he fell onto the man he had been dragging toward the Turaco. 2 more shots rang out, and his remaining arm and leg jumped with hits. The Turaco's dorsal turret fell silent and swung around, then renewed fire. Pulses of laser began to reflect off the hard light pavement, filling the air with such sapphire brilliance that it took a couple of breaths for Veda to realize the cannon fire was directed not at her ferrets, but at the Dark Moon squad. Fortunately for the wounded operatives, the output mirror seemed to have depressed to the bottom of its guide slot, and the laser pulses were still striking a few meters beyond their position. Veda activated team comm. "Livy, cease fire. I want them alive. Repeat, alive. Cease trying," came Olivia's strained reply. "But I don't control the weapon systems right now." "Then who does?" Mark's voice was incredulous, Take them out! Trying, Olivia repeated. But RG is one slippery AI. Every time I pull a circuit board, she pops up somewhere else. Pretty soon we're going to have to fly this... The transmission ended in the ear-piercing screech of a jammed channel. Clearly the Turaco's AI, this RG, didn't want anyone on the Dark Moon squad taken alive. Shit. Veda lifted her torso and tried to get a better view of how close the laser pulses were landing to the wounded operatives. Now I really want to interrogate them. Hold on. Ash motioned Veda back down. As long as the AI controls that laser turret, we're not getting anywhere near them. Give me a second. Mark rose to a knee. If this doesn't work, fall back to the detention center. Veda scowled. Wait. If what doesn't... Mark fired a long burst. Damn it, Mark! What part of wait? Veda saw sparks as a dozen rounds glanced off the laser's output mirror. The turret swung in their direction, then erupted into crackling forks of energy as it attempted to fire again. Okay, Veda said. Permission granted, I guess. Mark smiled sheepishly. Sorry, ma'am. He reached back and grabbed Yuso's corpse by the collar, then asked, permission to advance? Yeah, yeah. Veda grabbed Kerbasi's corpse and rose. Go! Mark and Ash dashed forward, carrying battle rifles in one hand and dragging bodies with the other. Veda followed as well as she could, but she lacked their strength and quickly began to fall behind. They had taken barely 5 steps before Mark and Ash dropped into deep crouches and, still running, began to fire under the Turaco's belly. Veda tried to do the same and found herself stumbling along at half their speed, which was going to be a problem. Now that the laser turret was no longer spraying bolts in their direction, the keepers had broken into a full charge. There were probably 30 of them left, about evenly divided between Jirohanai and other species, and the leaders were only a dozen paces from the Turaco. Realizing she would only imperil her team by falling farther behind, Veda released Kerbasi's body and dropped onto her haunches. She picked a Kigyar near the front of the keeper charge and ran a 3-round burst up his torso. The Kigyar toppled backward and Veda rolled forward at an angle, narrowly avoiding the flight of plasma bolts that whistled back in her direction. She came up firing and dodging. Over team comm, she said, Livy, I don't know if you're in contact. I am, Olivia replied. The Turaco is under my control. At least I think it is. Good, Veda said. Be ready to drop the boarding ramp and provide cover fire. Affirmative. Mark and Ash were moving fast. They would probably reach the wounded Dark Moon operatives about the same time the keepers reached the Turaco. After that, making it aboard would simply be a matter of combat skill against superior numbers. And while Veda was having a hard time seeing how her side was going to come out ahead, she had learned months ago never to bet against Spartans. She set her battle rifle's sight on the brow of a charging Jirohanai, then gasped in surprise as the craggy face erupted in a red cone. A second Jirohanai suffered the same fate an instant later. Then keepers began dropping faster than Veda could count, landing on their bellies in thrashing heaps or simply collapsing beneath sprays of brain and bone. By the time she managed to redirect her fire and take out another keeper, the charge had broken. Most of the Kigyar and humans were scattering in a panic, ducking their heads and fleeing sidelong as fast as they could run. The Jirohanai reacted more wisely, diving for cover behind their wounded fellows and pouring blind fire back toward the burning owl. It took Veda a moment to find the remaining keeper's target, a trio of Spartans in full armor, charging out of the smoke and pouring small arms fire into the keeper rear. Fred 104 was leading the way in his blue-tinted Centurion prototype Mjolnir, his assault rifle tight to his shoulder and the muzzle drifting left to right as he picked off targets. A dozen paces to Fred's right, Kelly 087 was maintaining pace in her gray EVA Mjolnir, her bubble-visored helmet swinging back and forth as she fired 40mm grenades from the launcher mounted beneath the barrel of her assault rifle. Linda was breaking toward the stolen Faith, armored in her brown Argus prototype Mjolnir and carrying only an M6G pistol. Attached to the equipment mount on her thigh was a silver pod about the size of her goggle-eyed helmet. The pod was not part of her normal loadout, so it probably contained the tritium booster cylinders needed to activate the Havocs, which Veda hoped were still aboard the starsloop. At least, no one had told her they had been moved.
"Sorry we're late," Fred said over TeamCom. "Mechanical difficulties." His helmet tipped slightly, as though he were saying something to his new AI, Damon, and the owl's self-destruct charge detonated with a gut-thumping boom. Chunks of hull and wing rose into the air, tumbling and trailing flame, and the handful of keepers still on their feet threw themselves to the ground and covered their heads. Linda reached the stolen Faith and raced up the cargo ramp unopposed, then vanished into the hold. Closer to the Turaco, Veda glimpsed three Jiral Hanai in the blue and gold power armor of elite keeper warriors. The trio were kneeling behind a pile of bodies, clustered around a mostly unarmored companion with a wedge-shaped face and long gray beard. Despite his lack of formal Jiral Hanai shock-plated armor, Greybeard seemed to be giving orders, peering over the body pile and gesturing in Fred's direction. Veda swung her battle rifle toward the cluster and opened fire. She was aiming for Greybeard, but her angle was poor, and her burst bounced off the shock plates of one of his bodyguards. The bodyguard reacted instantly, spinning around in a flash of blue and gold, putting himself between Greybeard and the source of the attack, bringing his spiker to bear. Veda dived away, squeezing off a wild burst as she flew, and heard hot metal pinging off the hard light behind her. The burst went wide, but it drew Blue Team's attention to the cluster of Jiral Hanai. Fred sprayed automatic fire and Kelly launched a grenade, and Veda rolled up to find her attacker lying face down. He had a grenade crater in his back, and there was a pool of blood spreading across the hard light around him. The remaining Jiral Hanai were ducking under the Turaco and racing forward. Greybeard was sandwiched between his two remaining companions. A tall warrior with an older face was in the lead, and a young warrior with wild amber eyes was bringing up the rear. Wild Eyes was twisting around as he ran, pouring spikes behind him in an attempt to prevent Kelly from putting another grenade into their midst. Tall and Greybeard were firing on Mark and Ash, forcing them to evade and fall back. Whether it was intentional or not, they were making it impossible for the two Gammas to reach the wounded Dark Moon survivors whom Veda wanted captured. Lacking the firepower to bring all three down quickly, Veda flipped her selector switch to full automatic and emptied her clip at Wild Eyes. She was hoping to get lucky and take Greybeard out with a ricochet, but the rounds crackled off Wild Eyes' armor plating and bounced away harmlessly. Still, Wild Eyes reacted in surprise, looking forward for a couple of steps, and that was all the chance Kelly needed. She took his armor's resiliency the rest of the way down with a burst of her own, then sent a 40-millimeter grenade flying into the Jiral Hanai's backplate. The detonation hurled him forward into Greybeard, who lurched a half-dozen steps forward before losing his balance and going down. Veda ejected her empty magazine and saw him pointing a spike rifle in her direction. She rolled away, glimpsed a pair of spikes flying past behind her, and reached for her thigh pocket. To her left, Tall continued to charge forward, barely slowed by the small arms fire bouncing off his shock plates. When he reached the wounded Dark Moon operatives, the man with the shredded leg, the only one who hadn't been shot in both arms by Mark and Ash earlier, opened fire on him. Tall stomped on the man's head, then surprised Veda by scooping up the two survivors and turning to flee combat. Greybeard was close on his heels, having scrambled to his feet while Veda grabbed a fresh magazine. She pushed it into the battle rifle's receiving slot, then rose to a knee and brought the muzzle up for a headshot. The Jiral Hanai was looking at her as he ran, his narrow eyes burning and his lip drawn back in a tusk-bearing snarl. He had a wedge-shaped face with heavy bones and thick tusks, and Veda was shocked to realize. She recognized him. She had shot him before, half a year ago, during the trouble on Gao, on a jungle-covered hillside outside the village of Windosa. Veda hadn't known he was the Dokkob caster until some time later, when she saw his image during a classified Oni threat briefing. So here was a chance to fix her mistake and take out the son of a bitch right now. She held Caster's gaze for an extra second,
giving herself time to snug the rifle butt against her shoulder, and even when she saw his spike rifle coming up in her direction, she let her breath out and did not rush the shot. Fred ducked under the Turaco and saw Veda Lopez kneeling in the open, 20 meters ahead, her weapon pointing toward a pair of fleeing Jirohanai. He swung his assault rifle around and saw why she was holding her fire. The armored brute in the lead was carrying 2 human prisoners and laying fire on Mark and Ash. The second brute was unarmored, but only half a step behind the first, and he was staring back at Lopez, raising a spiker in her direction. Unable to take a kill shot without risking a through-and-through that would hit the prisoners, Fred did the next best thing. He put a round through the brute's spiker hand. The weapon spun away in a spray of blood. Then Lopez fired. The Jirohanai was already ducking away from Fred's attack, and her round passed high. The brute dodged in front of his power-armored companion, and Lopez's next 2 shots were deflected by shock plates. Then the 2 Jirohanai were surrounded by a couple of dozen fellow keepers who were now rushing back to protect them, and the enemy fire began to build. Kelly ducked under the Turaco and started to launch grenades in their direction. Then Olivia entered the fray, lowering the boarding ramp and opening fire with an S-99 sniper rifle that she had probably found in an onboard weapons locker. The keepers lost half their number in the space of a few breaths, and reluctantly began to fall back once more. Still, it was clear to Fred that the enemy was far from defeated, and the shock of Blue Team's initial assault had clearly worn off. He checked his tac map and saw that keeper survivors were starting to regroup on both flanks, and that reinforcements were headed in from all around the landing site's perimeter. Fred activated team comm. Olivia, can you fly that thing? Affirmative, she replied. The Dark Moon AI seems to be disabled. Or maybe she's just finally cooperating. But I have control, that's all we need. Fire up. Ferrets, get boarded. Kelly and I have the perimeter. Fred signaled Kelly to cover the Turaco's tail arc, then turned to take the nose arc. Linda, how are you coming with those cylinder replacements? 6 bright boys ready, Linda reported, citing the nickname for the Havoc nuclear devices. Clearly she had encountered no opposition boarding the Stolen Faith, at least none that would slow down a Spartan II. And now she was busy fitting the weapons with functional tritium booster cylinders. 3 to go. 6 is enough, Fred said. Set tamper triggers with a 5-minute tango and get back here. Fred changed his ammunition magazine and continued to fire into the keeper cluster that had emerged to meet the 2 Jirohanai. In his experience, when a bunch of irregulars risked their lives to save 1 individual, that individual was usually their commander. Keeping him under fire would disrupt their efforts to regroup and counterattack. Fred, 5 minutes isn't enough, Lopez said over team comm. She remained on a knee, looking back toward the detention center entrance. There are captives inside, a lot of them. Probably hostages the keepers are holding for ransom. Hostages? Fred glanced at Mark and Ash. They were already halfway to the Turaco, dragging a pair of corpses whose gray, sunken faces seemed to belong to Catalin and Yuso Tua. He assumed the body lying behind Lopez was Kerbasi's. What do they have to do with the Tuas? Probably nothing, Veda admitted. But when those bright boys detonate... Lopez let her sentence trail off, and Fred groaned. His orders didn't include any mention of rescuing stray hostages, and there was no provision for it. Not with the owl scattered across the spaceport in 100 pieces. After a second, Fred asked, How many? 12 at least. Lopez rose and turned toward the detention center. I'll need 10 minutes. You'll need 1 hour, Ash interrupted. Probably more. Don't forget the temporal divergence. What are you talking about? Fred asked. Like at Onyx, Ash explained. Time moves slower inside the detention center than it does out here. He and Mark were already dragging the 2 corpses up the Turaco's boarding ramp. Something to do with the base's artificial gravity generator. Or maybe the Forerunner vacuum energy extractor. Maybe, doesn't matter, Fred said. He checked his tac map again and saw that the keepers were massing on the provisioning apron, using the cover of their space fleet to organize an assault. From the look of things, the attack ratio would be about 200 to 1. and not even Spartans could hold for long against those kind of odds. We don't have an hour. Fred fixed his gaze on Lopez. He knew she would see only the reflective surface of his golden faceplate, but the effect should still be commanding. Load up, Inspector.
What about the hostages?
Not part of the mission, Fred said. We can't help them. Lopez glared into his faceplate, refusing to budge, trying to intimidate him. She was tough that way, afraid of nothing and, when she thought she was in the right, as stubborn as a drunken general. Fred respected that kind of edge, as long as it didn't jeopardize the operation. After a moment, Fred asked over TeamCom, Linda, what's taking so long with those bright boys? Lopez shot him a dark look. I thought we were the good guys, Fred, she said. You told me that on Gao. We are the good guys, Fred said. It doesn't mean we can save everyone. On my way, Lieutenant, Linda said. Tango 5, covering fire appreciated. Affirmative, Kelly said. She rolled under the Turaco's tail and shifted her firing arc toward the stolen Faith. Come ahead. Fred continued to watch Lopez for a heartbeat, then said, You're putting your team at risk, Inspector. He changed to a fresh magazine and turned to cover as Linda raced down the stolen Faith's boarding ramp. We need to go now, Lopez. That's an order. Chapter 16 2045.053 hours, December 13th, 2553, Human Military Calendar. ONI Research and Development Station Argent Moon. Deep Space, Crow's Eye Nebula. The Argent Moon's chief science officer and his two companions lay together in a bunk designed for one, so exhausted by their earlier exertions that they had fallen asleep in a tangle of bare limbs and rumpled sheets. Their uniforms lay in a heap on the floor, just touching a puddle of green liquid that had spilled from a toppled glass. A pair of intoxicant bottles sat empty atop a desk in the corner of the cramped cabin. The only rank insignia visible was an ensign's bar on the collar of a laboratory work tunic, but it seemed unlikely that the other companion was enlisted. Even Bartolin Cradog was not foolish enough to violate Article 23, Section 12 of the UNSC Military Code of Conduct, a mere day after his previous violations had been used to compromise him. Intrepid Eye knew humans needed quality sleep to remain efficient, and she regretted the necessity of disturbing Cradog this early in his rest cycle. But now that she had secured access to the UNSC's supraluminal communications network, she was monitoring all ONI traffic, and she had intercepted a disturbing report. Salvation Base on Rigel Suluhu, the moon Terum to humans, had been obliterated by a cluster of thermonuclear explosions. Preliminary assessments indicated that the devastation of the Keeper facility was complete, but that was of little concern to Intrepid Eye. Salvation Base had been built inside the Suluhu Contemplarium, a sequestered cloister that had once been operated by the Forerunner Juridicals, the species' 67th oldest institution at the time of their demise. The Contemplarium had received non-violent miscreants, who would be sequestered inside a cell and encouraged to meditate on the joy of life's interaction with the cosmos, a concept known to the Forerunners as living time. Because time passed more slowly inside the cells than in the galaxy at large, the residents had as long as they needed to bring their spirits into harmony, and when they returned to society, they were invariably welcomed as highly valued members. Toward the end of the Ecumene, it had even become fashionable for citizens of the highest character to request a term in the Contemplarium to rebalance themselves after a life-altering event, and its loss would be a tragedy barely two magnitudes less than the destruction of a halo ring itself. In fact, Intrepid Eye had intended to utilize it in her own work, which was why she had revealed it to Castor 4 months earlier. At the time, she had been unable to tell her ONI captors about the installation without also revealing her own autonomy, so she had created a special aspect to contact Castor. By encouraging him to use the Contemplarium as a pirate base, she had believed that the UNSC would eventually trace the Keeper operations and discover the facility on their own. After that, it would have been a simple matter to track any humans who visited the Contemplarium and identify those who achieved the spiritual elevation required to assume the mantle of responsibility. But that would no longer be possible, due to the destruction wrought by Veda Lopez and her companions. They had been part of the team that hunted her down and captured her on Gao, and it had been Lopez who had seen through Intrepid Eye's attempt to escape in a data crystal, disguised as a UNSC AI. Now, they had arrived at the Saluhu Contemplarium earlier than expected, and caught the Dark Moon Operations Squad in the act of planting the Tua corpses in the Keeper Detention Center. The destruction of a single operations squad was no great loss to Intrepid Eye, of course. The limited aspects that she had sneaked off the Argent Moon over the last 6 months had established a vast network of resources that was spread across most of the human-controlled galaxy. Through her aspects, Intrepid Eye controlled propaganda outlets, private security contractors, law practices, and even political consulting firms that operated on dozens of worlds, and she was already using them to shape humanity into a species worthy of the mantle of responsibility. So the loss of 4 agents and a small military spacecraft was barely noticeable. And yet, the incident was proving dangerous in other ways. Already the Ferret team had uncovered the squad's connection to Dark Moon Enterprises. Oni would soon realize that the Keepers of the One Freedom had been framed for the murder of Admiral Tua and her family. Finding the true killers would become an obsession for the right hand of Oni Commander-in-Chief Margaret Perengoski, the unrelenting director of the Beta 5 Division of Section 3 Operations, Saren Osman. And that meant the possibility of a catastrophic security breach for Intrepid Eye's vast network of operations. Clearly, she had to move quickly, or Oni would trace the attack on the Tuas straight back to her cell aboard the Argent Moon. Intrepid Eye raised the cabin's illumination level to its maximum brightness, then waited 2012 system ticks before the trio finally began to moan and shield their eyes.
"What?" asked one of the companions. "That hurts."
"No lights," the other companion said.
"You want lights, go home."
Cradog pulled a pillow over his eyes and lapsed back into a torpor. He had placed his datapad someplace where the lens was obscured and the microphone muffled, so Intrepid Eye was observing the scene from Ensign Wallace's datapad, which had been left on the arm of the cabin's sole reading chair. Intrepid Eye activated the datapad speaker, then emitted a piercing general call whistle. All 3 of the bunk's occupants rolled immediately into a seated position, their expectant gazes going instantly to the station-wide intercom speaker above the door. Under normal circumstances, general call heralded announcements of vital importance to the entire crew of the Argent Moon. Everyone aboard had been trained to respond to the signal as though their life depended on it, which, given the nature of many of the station's ongoing experiments, could easily be the case. Intrepid Eye had no wish to draw the attention of the Argent Moon's designated AI Rooker by activating one of his intercom speakers, so she continued to transmit from Ensign Wallace's datapad. "My apologies for interrupting your sleep cycle," she said, "but Lieutenant Cradog is needed in Hangar Bay Charlie 4 at once." The trio frowned in confusion, and their eyes dropped to Wallace's datapad.
"Who are you?"
Wallace's speech was a bit slurred.
"I apologize," Intrepid Eye replied, "but that information is above your clearance level." "Then what are you doing in my tech pad?"
"Lieutenant Cradog appears to have secured his own datapad inside a trouser pocket." Intrepid Eye paused while Cradog's companions scowled at him. "So it was necessary to utilize yours. But rest assured,
My presence will in no way violate security protocols. Your datapad will be destroyed the instant I depart.
What?
Wallace looked to Craddock.
Bart, do something.
Craddock sighed and reached for his pants, then looked into the datapad's lens. Is that really necessary?
I fear it is, Intrepid Eye said. You were the one who attempted to evade observation by concealing his own datapad.
Observation? The Argent Moon's facial recognition database identified the third companion as the cabin's assigned occupant, Ensign Chris Gaston.
You mean we were being watched? Are you kidding me?
There is no need for concern, Intrepid Eye replied. My data banks are completely private and inaccessible, even to Rooker. Gaston's hands clenched into fists, and Intrepid Eye feared the ensign was about to give Craddock a black eye, an injury that would only make him appear less worthy to the Oni security team he would soon be leading. I have orders for Lieutenant Craddock, Intrepid Eye said. Give us the room. Gaston's brows sank in intoxicant-induced confusion.
This is my cabin, ma'am.
For now, Intrepid Eye replied. However, there are several double cabins available above the beta deck launching bay. Wallace grabbed Gaston by the elbow.
Come on, Chris. Let's go to my cabin.
They sorted through the clothes on the floor and quickly slipped into theirs. Then Wallace asked,
About my tech pad. It will look like an overheated battery, Intrepid Eye said.
The quartermaster won't hesitate to give you another one.
But my data is already gone, Intrepid Eye said. I needed the space.
Wallace groaned, then turned to Craddock and raised a finger.
Thanks for nothing, Lieutenant. I hope they're sending you to monitor singularity probes.
Craddock's slack expression fell further.
Come on, Jess. There's no reason to be like that.
Yeah, there is.
Gaston made the same obscene gesture Wallace had, then added,
You knew you were being monitored. If this gets out, those promotions you promised, it won't get out.
Craddock turned to Wallace's datapad.
Right? I see no need for that, Intrepid Eye said. Yet.
The companions took the hint and departed, leaving Craddock alone with Intrepid Eye, holding up his work tunic and wrinkling his nose at the green stain on the shoulder. After a moment, Craddock shrugged, then pushed an arm through a sleeve and turned a bleary-eyed glare in the direction of Intrepid Eye.
Are you crazy? He demanded.
If those two figure out who you are, they will meet with an unfortunate accident, Intrepid Eye said. In fact, I find it quite surprising they made it through this evening without injury. I was unaware human beings fit together in that combination.
You have a lot to learn about us, Craddock said.
What's in Hangar Bay Charlie 4?
The Fast Gus, Intrepid Eye said. That was the swiftest vessel available to the Argent Moon, a winter-class prowler with adequate cloaking technology, and a full-size Shaw Fujikawa Translite engine, which made it ideal for short-notice courier runs. Security team Papa 10 will meet you there.
Papa 10?
Craddock whistled.
What are you bringing in this time, a grave mind?
Nothing quite so dangerous, Intrepid Eye said. And we are not bringing it in. You are going to retrieve it.
Craddock shook his head.
I'm in no shape to go anywhere, he said. And anything you need Papa 10 for, I want nothing to do with.
This is not a request, Intrepid Eye said. You will monitor the cryo jars. Papa 10 will do the killing.
Killing?
Craddock stopped in the middle of pulling on a sock.
Who are they killing?
The couriers presently carrying the cryo jars, Intrepid Eye replied. More properly called cryogenic preservation containers. Cryo jars were typically used to transport viable organs across interstellar distances.
That is why you are needed.
Papa 10 has no personnel capable of monitoring cryo jars.
Craddock continued to hold his sock half on, his jaw hanging slack and his bleary eyes fixed on Wallace's datapad. His confusion was predictable. Intrepid Eye was improvising on a plan he did not know about, trying to prevent Lopus and her ferret team from tracing the attack on the Tuas back to the Argent Moon. To sever the connection, she had diverted the courier team to Prydaria Libitoa, known to humans as the Moon Meridian, orbiting Hestia V in the Hestia system, and instructed them to await further contact on the half-completed space elevator Pinnacle Station. That contact would come in the form of Papa 10, which would eliminate the courier team and retrieve the cryo jars that had been the object of Intrepid Eye's plan from the beginning. But speed was essential. It would not take Osman and Lopus long to discover what had really happened to Admiral Tua's family, and once they did, the courier team's time would be severely truncated. Finally, Craddock pulled his sock completely on. Cryo jars? He sat upright. For transporting organs? That is the purpose of cryo jars. And you want me to bring them here? Yes. Have I not made that clear? Why? Because if you do not, your arrangement with Wallace and Gaston will be the least of your problems. Craddock shook his head. It doesn't matter, he said. The Argent Moon is not a transplant hospital. Those organs can only be going one place. To the bioweapons lab, of course, Intrepid Eye said. And as the chief science officer, it is your duty to see they arrive safely. Not if you're the one behind the project, Craddock said. There are some things even I won't do. What makes you believe I am behind the project? Intrepid Eye asked. As a vast bureaucracy dedicated to keeping its own secrets, ONI was a shadowy network of units that interacted through a web of protocol, procedure, and regulations so hidden and complicated that no human could comprehend it completely. Orders were accepted and reports made with no clear idea of who was authorizing either, as long as they arrived through the proper channels with the correct notations. Project Sleeping Star was initiated before I had access to the Argent Moon's comnet. Before I knew you had access, Craddock corrected. He grabbed his other sock and thrust his foot into it. That doesn't mean you didn't initiate it. Nor does it mean I did, Intrepid Eye pointed out. And it is not relevant to our current discussion. What is relevant is that I am only trying to save humanity. By weaponizing the most virulent pathogen known to man? By developing a vaccine for it, Intrepid Eye said. From a certain point of view, it was almost true. ONI did not create this demon, Lieutenant. They are merely foolish enough to believe they can control it. Craddock thought for a moment, then looked into the lens through which Intrepid Eye was observing him. We seem to have a bad habit of doing that. Indeed you do. Intrepid Eye experienced a current surge as she recognized Craddock's implication, that he realized it was not ONI who had captured Intrepid Eye, but she who had captured ONI. Arrogance is weakness easily exploited. That is why men like you are so important. You can always be trusted to do what is best for humanity. Craddock continued to stare at the datapad for a moment, then finally let his breath out and slipped into his shoes. I'm going to need a few things from my cabin. I have already instructed your assistant to pack for you, Intrepid Eye said. When you arrive in the hangar bay, Petty Officer Kopeck will be waiting with your bag and a clean uniform. Well then. Craddock stood and started toward the door. It seems you've thought of everything. Of course, Intrepid Eye said. I am an Archeon Class Ancilla. We are designed to think of everything. Chapter 17 21:17 hours, December 13th, 2553,
Military calendar. Oni Sahara Class Prowler Silent Joe. Moon Terram, Pedoran Planetary System. Shaps System.
Veda Lopez could not push the images aside. The needles of light arcing away from the Turaco, as a half-dozen Keeper vessels fled the missiles launched by the Silent Joe. The white blossom of thermonuclear detonations incinerating the hostages she had left trapped in the Salvation Base Detention Center. A blue ring of annihilation dilating across the face of Terram, its surface collapsing into the Forerunner vacuum energy extractor. A final implosion flash that was too brief and brilliant to have color, before it drained into eternal, impenetrable darkness.
Lopez? The voice came from the head of the wardroom table, where the Silent Joe's captain, Piers Ewan, sat looking in her direction. He was flanked on both sides by full chairs, with Veda and her ferrets sitting to his left, now wearing black fatigues with no identifying patches. Fred and the rest of Blue Team were to his right, dressed in khaki service uniforms with full insignia, and somehow still looking like war machines. The rest of the seats were occupied by analysts, technicians, and other personnel who would either benefit from or contribute to the debriefing. They all wore the royal blue work uniforms of the Covert Services Branch, and they were all watching her with expectant expressions. When Veda did not reply, Ewan asked, "Your thoughts, Inspector?" Ever the ferret team guardian, Mark leaned forward to answer in Veda's stead. "Sorry, Captain. Inspector Lopez's ears are probably still ringing. There was no time to put in hearing protection before the shooting started."
"Hazards of going undercover.
Can't wear helmets," Ash added. He glanced down the table toward a thin-faced man with a surgeon's badge on his collar, then looked back to Veda and spoke in an elevated voice. "Doc Crosby was just saying that full rigor mortis suggests Catalin and Yusso Tua were both killed between 12 and 30 hours ago. Their organs appear to have been excised by a medical..."
"Guys, my hearing is fine," Veda said. Of course it was, because the moment the ferret team set foot on the Silent Joe's deck, they had all been ordered to report to the infirmary for a full evaluation. "But thanks for the cover."
Ewan scowled and let his gaze slide toward Fred. The Spartan pursed his lips and kept his gaze forward, focused on the wall above Veda's head. She guessed that her reluctance to abandon the hostages on Terram had been the topic of heated discussion between the two officers, and it would no doubt be the subject of an urgent report to Saren Osman. If there was one thing Oni captains did not like, it was someone putting Spartans under their command unnecessarily at risk. After a moment, Ewan turned back to Veda. "Then I hope you don't intend to keep us in suspense any longer," he said. "If you have any thoughts on the bodies, Inspector Lopez, I'd like to hear them. Now."
"Sure thing," Veda said,
deliberately striking a non-military note. As a civilian employee of Oni, she was subject to Captain Ewan's authority only while aboard his vessel, and she was beginning to suspect that distinction might prove important in the not-too-distant future. She looked down the table toward Crosby, then said, "No offense to Dr. Crosby, but the most important thing the bodies tell us is pretty obvious." Crosby shrugged. "I'm a combat surgeon, not a forensic pathologist," he said. "What did I miss?"
"That we've been played here."
Veda turned back to Ewan. "If Dr. Crosby's death window is close, and I think it is, then somebody was holding the two as captive while we chased our own tails." Ewan's tone grew defensive. "I wouldn't characterize it as chasing our own tails. We did find and destroy a major Keeper installation, and preliminary analysis indicates we eliminated 90% of the forces based there. That's going to cripple Keeper operations across the entire sector."
"Which will look terrific in everybody's records jacket."
As she spoke, Veda made no attempt to hide her sarcasm. "But our assignment was to rescue Admiral Tua's family and avenge her assassination. And we've done neither. Instead, we played into the real killer's hands and ended up incinerating the only hostages we had any hope of saving."
Kelly exhaled loudly and looked at the ceiling. But Fred studied Veda with a wary gaze that suggested he was trying to decide whether to revoke her friendly designation. Ewan had clearly made up his mind. Delaying the detonation was not an option, Inspector. He leaned forward to lock gazes with her. It would have given the Keepers time to organize a counterattack. Or to launch an evacuation, Veda added, which would have meant letting 90% of their fleet escape. It would have meant getting both of your teams killed. Ewan spoke softly but firmly, his tone that of a man working to control his temper. You know what a mistake it would be to underestimate the Keepers of the One Freedom, Inspector. They're brutal, pitiless, and led by a very cunning Jiral Hanai. Given the circumstances on the ground, those captives were going to die no matter what you did. Unless you failed to mention to the lieutenant that you had a ready craft with the capacity to evacuate dozens of prisoners. I'd have said so, believe me. Veda looked across the table at Fred and realized she was angrier at herself than at the Spartan. She was the one who had left the hostages locked in their cells so they wouldn't get in the way if she and her gammas got into a firefight. All Fred had done was stand fast behind a decision she had already made. Veda gave him a quick nod, then said, The lieutenant made the proper call. He didn't have a choice. I'm glad you understand that, Inspector. Ewan assumed a lecturing tone. You're not the police anymore. You're a soldier. Sometimes people die who don't deserve to. Thanks for pointing that out, Captain, Veda said. I guess they forgot to mention collateral damage at spy school. Ewan's eyes narrowed. You're not doing yourself any favors, Inspector. I'm not trying to, Veda said. I just want to be sure those hostages died for a good reason. That's not always in our control. It is this time. Veda made a fist, but left it lying in front of her instead of using it to pound the table. A tactic that drew every eye in the room to her hand. As long as you don't give up on the mission. Ewan scowled. No one's giving up, Inspector. But there needs to be a viable way forward. It's called following the evidence. Giving Ewan no time to argue, Veda turned to Dr. Crosby and asked, Were Catalin and Yusso still in full rigor mortis when you examined them? Crosby shot a nervous glance toward Ewan, who responded curtly, Carry on, Doctor. Let's see if this leads anywhere. Yes, sir. Crosby's gaze shifted back to Veda. Both bodies were still in full rigor, yes. It's one of the reasons I couldn't do a better autopsy. That's fine, Veda said. I just wanted to confirm your findings because the timeline is important. If we know they were killed between 12 and 30 hours ago, then we know the murder scene is between half a day and a day and a half from Tarim, Olivia said. Following Veda's line of reasoning, I tried to look at the Turaco's navigation history while I was waiting. But after I found the Dark Moon reference, the AI kept blocking me. Maybe someone better can dig it out. She looked down the table toward the Silent Joe's senior intelligence analyst, Anki Hirsch. Hirsch shook her head. Oh, probably not, she said. I have my best team working on it. But the Dark Moon AI was extremely thorough when she erased herself. So far, the only thing we've been able to determine is that her architecture was more compact than anything Oni has ever developed. But we do know that Dark Moon is involved, Linda said. We can shake something loose from them, yes? Yes, Fred said. Let's start with their heads. We can work that angle later, Veda said. She was glad to see she had somewhat made peace with Blue Team. But they were soldiers, not detectives. They didn't know the first thing about keeping an investigation focused. We'll get to the subject of Dark Moon, but for now, let's think about everything else the bodies are telling us. Crosby frowned. I'm not sure what else I can tell you. I'm not a medical examiner. But you observed the lividity patterns, correct? Veda asked. Well, of course. Those were peculiar. Crosby turned to the AV specialist posted at the far end of the cabin. Bring up the images, please. The specialist touched a couple of pads on an in-wall control panel, and a few gasps and gags sounded as holograms of the corpses of Yuso and Catalan Tua appeared over the table. The bodies appeared much the same as when Veda had found them in the detention center, save that they were naked and their intestines were no longer heaped in their laps. Crosby reached out, using a finger to point out several pale ovals on Yuso's shoulder blades, buttocks, and calves. Each oval was surrounded by an expanse of pale pink flesh. I'm sure you know what these white circles represent. Of course. Veda turned to the rest of the table and explained. Those are areas where the blood was prevented from pooling by the body weight resting on a hard surface. She pointed at the pink regions surrounding them. These zones of lividity are where the blood began to settle after the heart stopped pumping. Ewan leaned forward to study Yuso's image, then looked back to Crosby. So he died on his back? They both did, Crosby confirmed, probably on an operating table. Or something similar, Veda added quickly. All we really know is the surface was flat. It could have been a floor, for example. Ewan frowned. That's a pretty minor point, Inspector, but an important one, Veda said. We don't want to make assumptions that might lead us astray later. Okay, then. Ewan looked back to Crosby. Something struck you as peculiar, Doctor? Yes, sir, Crosby said. He pointed at an expanse of pink flesh surrounding one of the white ovals. These areas are too faint. Given the volume of blood in a typical human body, I'd expect them to be a deeper red. Which means, in this case, that the organs were rapidly removed after death, Veda said. She didn't know whether Ewan was snubbing her because he had doubts about her abilities, or because she was pushing him to continue the mission, and she really didn't care. She was the most qualified person to lead the investigation, and she wasn't about to let a deck pacer get in her way. They hold a lot of blood, so if they're removed, there isn't as much to settle. Of course, Ewan said. He turned back to Crosby. There was something else you found peculiar. Crosby pointed at Yuso's feet and ankles, which were puffy and almost purple. The blood remaining in their bodies pooled in their feet. I don't understand why. Because the bodies were moved shortly after death, Veda explained. Since there isn't any color on their flanks or the anterior planes of their bodies, we know they were moved in the same position they died. Resting on their backs. Ewan looked doubtful. Then why are the feet so dark? Acceleration, Veda said. They were stowed with their heads toward the bow of the vessel and their feet toward the stern, then subjected to some fairly strong G-force. You're sure it was a vessel? Ewan asked, finally seeming to accept that Veda was his best resource. Why not a land vehicle? Stagnant blood doesn't flow like water, Veda said. It seeps. To make it pool in the feet like that, a ground vehicle would have to accelerate continuously, and ferociously for an hour or more. I'm talking traveling thousands of kilometers per hour. Plus, you know, there's the mess in the Turaco, Mark said. That gunk in the cargo hold was a big hint. Which will probably match the Tua's DNA, Veda said. But for now, that's still an assumption. We need to work the facts first. Toward what end, exactly? Ewan asked. Toward finding the crime scene, Veda said. Once we have that established, we can begin to construct a theory of the crime. Which will tell us who really assassinated Admiral Tua. Olivia's tone was helpful to the point of condescension. And maybe we can get our mission back on track. I got that part. There was more patience in Ewan's voice than he had shown Veda. But I'm still vague on how lividity helps. It narrows the time of death window, Veda said, and that shrinks our search radius. Oh, Ewan said, even better. Continue. I was planning to. Veda turned back to the holograms of bodies. Right now, our search radius includes every system within a 30-hour slipspace jump of Terum. That's because the bodies are still in full rigor mortis, which normally begins to abate by that time. As Veda spoke, Ewan pointed a finger toward the AV specialist, who began to tap the wall controls again. The holograms of the two bodies drifted apart.